Hi, everybody, and welcome to Martin Bandyke Undercovers for April 2018, produced in partnership with the Ann Arbor District Library. As lead singer and songwriter for the Velvet Underground and a renowned solo artist, Lou Reed invented alternative rock. His music, a source of beauty and noise, violated all definitions of genre while speaking to millions of fans and inspiring generations of musicians. But while his iconic status may be fixed, the man himself was anything but. Lou Reed's life was a Transformers odyssey, eternally restless and endlessly hungry for new experiences. Reed reinvented his persona, his sound, even his sexuality, time and again. He was a man of contradictions and extremes, fiercely independent, yet afraid of being alone, artistically fearless, yet deeply paranoid. Now, just a few years after Lou Reed's death, Rolling Stone writer Anthony DeCurtis, who knew Lou Reed and interviewed him extensively, tells the provocative story of his complex and chameleonic life. I began my interview with Anthony DeCurtis by asking him when was the first time that he talked to and had a chance to hang out with Lou Reed.
Well, the first time I met him, interestingly, was at the opening of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland. There was a big concert there. I think this was in 1995 or 96. And there was a big concert there to celebrate the opening. Lou played. He was backed up by Soul Asylum. And I was there. I was working at VH1 at the time and was coming back home and was at the airport the next day. The concert was on Saturday, and we were at the airport on Sunday, and all the planes were delayed. You know, I guess weather was bad or something. And there was a record company executive I know named Jeff Gold, who worked with Lou Reed, who was there with Lou Reed and Laurie Anderson, and their flights were delayed as well. So he introduced us. And we ended up spending, you know, 3 hours in the airport lounge just, you know, hanging around and talking. And I think, you know, I think that was helpful. I mean, I had written about Lou. In fact, I mean, the first thing he said when he heard my name, he just said, you know, you reviewed the New York album for Rolling Stone, right? And I said, yeah. And he said, how many stars did you give it? And I said, 4. And he goes, I should have been 5. You know, but he was laughing, and, you know, the fact that we were in this kind of social situation rather than an interview situation, which, as you know, could be fraught for him, I think that was something that really, you know, helped kind of grease the wheels of, you know, our relationship. You know, we kind of got to know each other under relatively kind of casual circumstances, and, you know, I think everybody understands the tedium of being stuck in the airport, and we just all kept each other amused, and so that was the first time I ever spoke to him.
Now, give us some info about his background. Did he have a good relationship with his parents, within his family, growing up? He's a musician who just pushed so many, pushed the envelope in so many different ways. Was he always like that, even from when he was a little kid, Anthony?
I'm afraid he was always like that, yes. I mean, in fact, that's one of the things that, that you know, people have noted, that, you know, he really does seem to, you know, kind of have, he's just characterologically, you know, been the same ever since he was a kid. He had a fraught relationship with his parents. I mean, there's no question about that. You know, he was acting out in pretty significant ways. He was using drugs, going to gay bars while, you know, his parents are living a very kind of conventional suburban Long Island life. And, you know, Lou's kind of sneaking off to go to gay bars. This is back in the 50s. Mm. And also there was a sense in which, you know, there's kind of these mood swings. You know, I mean, his behavior was very, you know, unpredictable. you know, at the same time, he was doing well in school and he had friends. It was always this kind of doubleness about him. But his parents got sufficiently concerned about his behavior that, they wanted to treat it in some way. And the result of that was a series of electroshock treatments, which, you know, was not that uncommon at the time, but still turned out to be very traumatic for Lou. I mean, he never forgave his parents for that. And there was a sense in which, his mother felt guilty, really, until the end of her life over it. His father, I think, believed, that he had done the best he could. I mean, he went on the advice of these physicians and, and Lou was creating problems. So it was a tense situation. And, Lou was always very kind of guarded around his parents. I mean, he would rarely see his parents without his sister being there. He had a younger sister. He also, but at the same time, whenever Lou kind of got into a fix, when he quit the Velvet Underground, he went back home to live with his parents. And, I remember talking to his first wife about, their living conditions. And she was saying, they were in, Lou didn't have much money and he was kind of cheap and he would never ask his parents for money. And I just said, well, would his father have given him money? Because I'd always, Lou had always talked about his father as being this extremely forbidding person. And she said, of course that he would have given him money. Hmm. Lou was kind of the, he was the oldest son in a Jewish family. And, I think he had all the standing that entails. And so it was complicated. I mean, he dedicated his first, when he published a book of lyrics called Between Thought and Expression, he dedicated it to his parents and his sister. So there was a lot of, there was a lot of complexity to that relationship. On the one hand, he would write a song called Kill Your Sons, in which he essentially vilifies the whole family. And at the same time, he would dedicate a book to them and, be cordial to them when he, saw them in person, and even sweet in the case of his mother. So it was loaded. I mean, it was very loaded.
Yeah. How did he first get into music, and how did he first meet this very pivotal person in his life, John Cale, as the Velvet Underground started to form?
Well, Lou was, was a kid who fell in love with rock and roll in its earliest days. I mean, he listened to the radio and was really just kind of swept away by, the great music that he heard. I mean, he loved all this early R&B, loved doo-wop, and, music that people don't necessarily associate with Lou Reed. But then later, even as a teenager, he formed bands and even did some recording. And when he got out of college, he went to Syracuse University. He had bands there also. And when he got out, he went to work for a company called Pickwick Records, which was really this kind of knockoff company. They would make, essentially knockoff versions of, if beach music was happening, they had staff songwriters, Lou Reed among them, who would write a bunch of like beach oriented tunes. Lou wrote one called Cycle Annie that really sounds just like Jan and Dean. And, it was put on the record as the Beach Nuts, and they would put together a band, to perform these songs and record them. They'd sell them in 5 and 10s, and kind of unwitting young people, like me at the time, would buy those. It was, while he was working at Pickwick, however, he wrote a song called Do the Ostrich, which, was based on something he'd read in a fashion column that ostrich feathers were going to be fashionable. And so he wrote this kind of dance song that really sounds like a garage rock track, but, and people got interested in it. And,
So they wanted a band to go out and play Do the Ostrich at various kind of afternoon, like local TV shows and things like that. So they had to put a band together. And in the course of that, that's when Lou Reed met John Cale. John Cale was one of the members of the Primitives. And, you know, John, of course, was an avant-garde musician in New York who was interested in taking those ideas and trying to find a larger audience for them. You know, Lou was a kind of literary kid who loved music and wanted to try to combine his interest in literature with rock and roll. And so they found a kind of common ground, and the seeds of the Velvet Underground were formed by the Primitives doing Do the Ostrich.
How did the Velvets, once they got together with the original lineup that we know so well, first come to meet Andy Warhol and have him ostensibly produce that first album, The Velvet Underground and Nico?
Well, Warhol, in his way, in the same way he got interested in movies, you know, I mean, obviously he started out as a visual artist, and then there was this sense of like, oh, well, the movies are happening, maybe we should make movies, and he started making movies, and then, you know, he said, well, gee, rock and roll is getting really popular, maybe we should have a rock band. Hmm. And various, you know, people on the scene at the Factory, which was Warhol's studio, you know, would go around and listen to bands, and the Velvets were doing a residency at a club called the Cafe Bazaar down in Greenwich Village. And, you know, some friends of Warhol, you know, went down there and saw them and, you know, suggested that he and Paul Morrissey, sort of his right-hand man, come down and check out the band, which they did. And they liked it because it was kind of noisy and different. And they also were responsible for affixing Nico to the band. Their sense was that the members of the Velvet Underground on their own were boring, quote unquote, on stage. And so they needed, you know, like an amazing, you know, German beauty like Nico to be their lead singer. Lou was initially opposed to this, but he, I think, understood that, you know, an alignment with Warhol was a really valuable thing at the time. So he went along with it, and essentially that's how the Velvet Underground and Nico came about.
And then the album came out, and basically no one really cared at the time, and it didn't, and it sold very miserably, didn't it?
Yes. Yeah, it didn't do well at all. And there was a sense in which, I mean, the famous quote from Brian Eno about the Velvet Underground and Nico was that only 30,000 people bought it, but every one of those 30,000 people formed a band.
And I got my hand up in the air, yes. I'm one of those 30,000 people. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I mean, that was, you know, and, you know, that was true. You know, there was a sense in which its impact would be felt only over time. But, you know, at the time, it really didn't make much of an impact. And, you know, Warhol was a kind of mixed bag in that regard, because on the one hand, he got the band noticed. You know, he did an album cover, the famous Banana album cover that, yeah, you know, is now iconic. But at the same time, you know, Warhol was perceived certainly by, you know, rock and roll was a very earnest world. And, you know, Warhol was perceived as a kind of ironist. And, you know, it wasn't like a proper mating. You know, it almost made people suspicious of the Velvet Underground. You know, but obviously as time has gone on, you know, that record has been recognized, you know, as supremely important. But yeah, but when it came out, it didn't make much of an impact at all.
The second album, the follow-up, White Light, White Heat, I remember listening to, I think I had an early cassette, Sony Walkman, I think, cassette player, and snuck it into gym class. And it's a couple years, actually, after the album came out. It just took me a little while to discover it. And I was listening to White Light, White Heat surreptitiously. I shoved the cassette recorder under, like, some of the mats in gym class. And I still to this day, Anthony, think about the sounds on White Light, White Heat, and it was so, it was beyond comprehension. I just, my mouth was just wide open going, I've never heard anything. This is frightening. This is enthralling. This is exciting. This is the most incredible thing I've ever heard in my life. And what was the band going through when they put out and when they recorded White Light, White Heat? Again, another album that at the time sold basically nothing, correct?
Yes. Yeah, less than the first by far. And it's a much more challenging record in a way. I mean, it's a much kind of harsher, aggressive sounding album. You know, I mean, enthralling, as you say, but, you know, still a much rougher go than the first album. You know, there were relatively few of the moments of beauty that are on the Velvet Underground and Nico. Well, the band was going through a lot of upheavals. You know, I mean, drugs were always a factor in the Velvet Underground, and, you know, certainly both, you know, Lou and John Cale were heavily indulging in hard drugs. And there was also, you know, Lou effectively pushed Nico out of the band, was in the process of pushing Cale out of the band, was in the process of extricating the band from its relationship with Andy Warhol. So there was a lot of turmoil, you know, surrounding the band around the time that they were making White Light, White Heat. And so that a lot of that is reflected in the sound, you know, on the album. I mean, it's a much rawer record than, you know, than the Velvet Underground and Nico.
The album notably produced by Tom Wilson, who worked with so many other great artists, Bob Dylan and Frank Zappa, just to mention a few. Did Tom Wilson have much of a say or much control over the band and what they were doing in the studio when they did this album?
Not really. I mean, Tom Wilson essentially, you know, was of the camp that Nico was the star of the band. And so the fact of Nico's absence, was not necessarily to his liking. And, and he certainly was not able to, work with the band in anything like the way, you know, he worked with Dylan, and certainly what he did with Simon and Garfunkel. And, you know, there was a sense in which, I mean, the Velvet Underground, even back then, were very stubborn. You know, they felt like they had their own vision of what they wanted to do. And I think, you know, Warhol was still sufficiently on the scene to kind of act as a protector, you know, for the, you know, I mean, he wanted the Velvets. I mean, famously, he told Lou Reed, you know, make sure you keep all the dirty words in. Don't let them make you change that. And I think Warhol, you know, sort of functioned that way for the band, you know, gave them a kind of stature that, you know, a band starting out making its second album wouldn't necessarily have had. So they made the record they wanted to make. And, obviously Tom Wilson was part of that, but, could not really exercise a kind of shaping role on it.
And then the third release, the band's self-titled album, a total and brilliant about face. John Cale, as you mentioned, is forced out of the band by Lou. Doug Ewell joins the group. And yes, you're going, as many people have noted, from the song Heroin on the first album to the song Jesus on the Velvet Underground's third album, their self-titled album. What accounted for this about face in the band's sound on this third release?
Well, in a lot of ways, Cale's absence was a significant part of it. Yeah. I mean, you know, John was, I think someone who really probably had the most conviction in terms of trying to push the Velvets' sound as far out to the edge as it could go. And since he was no longer in the band, I think kind of Lou's pop instincts came to the fore a little bit more. And also, I think this became a moment when you know, I think Lou was really interested, and certainly the record company was very interested in them having a hit and, you know, getting some radio play. So the songs on that album, which may be my favorite Velvet Underground album, you know, are to one degree or another kind of conventional rock and roll songs and ballads, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, they're interesting. I mean, there are sort of long droning sections that are great, and there are also, you know, moments of great beauty, you know, a song like Pale Blue Eyes, for example, you know. So I think that, you know, this was a kind of move on Lou's part to try to get a bigger audience for the Velvet Underground.
And then comes Loaded in 1970, despite the fact that the band has not sold many albums at all. They managed to get signed to the prestigious Atlantic Records, and the Loaded album gets recorded. Two of the band's most iconic songs, Rock and Roll and Sweet Jane, are on there. Certainly the most commercial potential they've ever shown. And Lou Reed leaves the band. What went on here with Loaded and Lou deciding to leave the band and go solo at that point? Right when really there might have been a chance for the group to actually make some money with their music with these two incredible songs on the Loaded album.
Well, you know, there was a lot of pressure on the band at that point, a lot of pressure on Lou. The group's manager at the time, this guy named Steve Sesnick, was a kind of maneuvering to try to kind of working behind Lou's back to essentially push Lou out of the band, and, you know, more or less succeeded in doing that. There was a sense in which, you know, Lou was just kind of worn out, I think. You know, again, drugs may have had something to do with that, but, you know, the sort of joke, in a sense, about the album's title, Loaded, is that it was supposed to be loaded with hits. I mean, Loaded also has,
yeah,
you know, suggestions about, you know,
yes, being high. Yeah, yeah.
But there was a sense, I think, of Lou just feeling frustrated with what was happening with the group. And, you know, during the course of making that record, Maureen Tucker, you know, wasn't really that involved. And she was kind of, in a sense, the glue of the band. I mean, everybody liked her. And I don't know, it just turned out to be a mess. But yeah, there are two iconic songs on there. There are a number of other really good songs on there. But it never... yeah, the band had broken up by the time the album came out. It was, you know, Lou, you know, one night they were doing a series of shows at Max's Kansas City. And on the last night of that, Lou just said, "Oh, I'm quitting the band," and went back to his house on Long Island and went to work for his father. So it was, yeah, I mean, that was a kind of low point. I wouldn't even say Lou was going solo. I'm not sure what his ambitions were at that point, or if he even had any. I think he was just confused and frustrated. You know, music, I think, was one possibility. I think he thought about writing full-time. And, you know, whatever else maybe came along. But it was, you know, it wasn't as if he left with a very clear plan about what he wanted to do.
Lou Reed's solo career, over all the years that he put out albums, Anthony, you go a few years, a couple albums, and I'd give up on him, frankly. There would be a few albums where it was, you know, I'm not hearing anything on this. This man is a spent force. And then he comes back with Street Hassle, or, you know, pick your album. Come, you know, the early period of Transformer in Berlin, just absolutely sensational. And then something is completely, I mean, his record, I can imagine what his record company thought when he presented them with Metal Machine music, you're ready to give up on this man, and with artistically, and then comes New York in 1989, followed by Magic and Loss. His solo career just has so many highs and lows. It's just fascinating to read your account of him as a solo artist. And his personal life, yeah, was just in so much turmoil so much of the time, wasn't it?
Very true. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, there was a lot happening with him. I mean, it was, some of that, those ups and downs that you describe in the solo career really had to do with his own ambivalence in a funny way about the kind of success that he wanted. You know, when it came to him with Walk on the Wild Side and Transformer, you know, I think he felt a little funny about it. And, you know, Berlin, which is now recognized as a great album,
yeah,
you know, was still pretty rough stuff. That wasn't necessarily the move to follow your big hit record, because it's, you know, it was challenging and it was dark, it wasn't Walk on the Wild Side 2, to be sure. And that was a kind of move, certainly through the 70s, Lou did that very regularly. Yeah, because he also had Rock and Roll Animal, which was a big record then, you know, and then, in the mix of all this stuff comes Metal Machine Music, which was, you know, essentially an hour of just, you know, roaring feedback, you know, that, you know, just kind of outraged people. Now also, by the way, recognized, in the kind of avant classical world as an important work of art. But at the time, you know, a kind of career killer. I think, you know, the 70s were a tough period for Lou. I mean, I think he, his drug use was just very, very out of control. I mean, we're talking at a point where, coming close to death, you know, any number of times.
And we're talking what? What was he doing? This is speed, methamphetamine that
speed,
he was...
Speed, know? Yeah, primarily. That was his, you know, that was sort of his, his drug of choice. And, and sort of various variations on that. And drinking, you know, really prodigiously.
Oh, what a combo.
I mean, he wrote a song during this period called The Power of Positive Drinking.
Yeah, yeah.
And, that doesn't necessarily make for, you know, the most kind of linear career decisions, you know. I mean, I think, you know, toward the end of the 70s, beginning of the 80s, when he began to clean up, you know, I think we could debate the quality of the work of this or that album, but I think the clarity with which he was working increased very significantly.
Hmm. As far as his solo work, can you name an album or two that's a particular favorite of yours?
Yeah. I'm so inside them at this point. I mean, there are things I like about them that I would not expect necessarily other human beings to like. But let's see. I mean, an album that I feel is very underrated is New Sensations.
Oh, yeah.
Which was one of the 80s albums. There's a song on there called Doing the Things That We Want To. And the title track, New Sensations. I find both of those songs, like, really moving. Coney Island Baby is a record I just love. Coney Island Baby and Street Hassle kind of... Coney Island Baby came out in 1976, and Street Hassle, you know, came out, you know, a couple of years later. They kind of bookend Lou's relationship with a transgender woman named Rachel, which was a kind of extremely radical gesture at the time. I mean, this wasn't just a kind of, like, fling. You know, they lived together as a couple. And Lou dedicated Coney Island Baby to Rachel and kind of chronicled the end of their relationship in a section of the song Street Hassle called Slip Away that is really heartbreaking to listen to. Mm. And that was one of the revelations of the book was, to me, was the depth of the relationship between the two of them. that was something I'd known about and thought, kind of Lou, he's crazy. But in fact, it was a real relationship and something, you know, really profound. So those records, are ones that I hold up. I love Magic and Moss. New York, of course, is a record I hold in esteem. Yeah. And of the later ones, I really like Ecstasy a lot. That was a late album. I mean, and that came and went without getting much attention at all. But in fact, I feel like it was kind of overlooked.
I think it was around the time of Ecstasy is when I was asked by his label, hey, do you want to do a phone interview with Lou Reed? And I thought, oh boy, I knew all the stories. And I thought, well, I got to do it. It's a rite of passage as a radio host. Let's do the interview with Lou Reed. Thank God it was taped, Anthony. And it was, I've interviewed many, many hundreds of artists, and it was impossible to talk to him virtually. He was so rude and so dismissive of my questions and my thoughts. I'm not an idiot. I worked for 20 years at an NPR station. I carefully researched the album. I didn't want to just talk about the Velvet Underground. I was really focusing on this, did my due diligence. And for lack of a better word, he was just a total prick to me. And I had to edit the shit out of the interview. And I had maybe 4 minutes left that was arable. And I just thought, well, why did you even let your record company set something up if you were going to be so completely impossible? I mean, people ask, God, do you have a diminished viewpoint of him after an experience like that? It's like, no, absolutely not. He's an absolute genius. But it's like, what is it? It's like, is it like some self-destruct button or something? Like, why even, see, like, just like to toy with, like, with pleasant Midwestern DJs like me? Like, why was he like this to so many journalists? Not you, apparently, but did he get off on this? Or what was the issue with him, Anthony?
Well, I think there was a number of different things. I'm sure you realize that there was nothing personal.
He was
kind of locked into a place where he would go.
Yes.
And why he would do it, I mean, I came to, you know, this was something that really became his mode later on. I mean, it wasn't really true, in the 70s, for example. Mm. And I think he had given so many interviews when he was drunk and high and said outrageous and horrific things that I think that going into interviews was fraught for him, and that any time he thought, rightly or wrongly, that that there was going to be like any kind of historical element to the interview or any kind of personal element to the interview, there were all of these things that he felt, he would never use these terms, but I think he felt humiliated and ashamed about. We're going to come up. And so consequently, he would lash out. And quite arbitrarily, look, your story, as gripping as it is one I've heard, honestly.
Right. Hundreds of times, probably.
Dozens of times, yeah. I mean, from people like yourself, who are obviously intelligent and care and respectful and, admire his work. So it was certainly not anything that was brought on by anything that was personal in the situation, but it was his own internal insecurities and anxieties that would come out, and then which he would just translate into anger and a kind of disdain.
Mm. Let's close this out with one question. And thank you. You're so generous with your time. I appreciate it, Anthony. I so very much agree with you where you write that along with Bob Dylan, the Beatles, and James Brown, Lou Reed is one of the absolute most influential artists in popular music. But one single that Graves' Walk on the Wild Side got in the top 20, no hit albums for I bet a lot of people, you go Lou Reed, Velvet Underground, and a lot of people would go, who, what? Everyone knows the Beatles and the Stones and James Brown. What makes him so important?
The impact he had on artists, you know. You know, if you go back and look at the people who tweeted, for example, when Lou Reed died, you know, it was kind of everybody. You know, Miley Cyrus was tweeting about Lou Reed. You know, there was a sense in which he stood as a symbol. I mean, almost as important as his music was the kind of symbolic quality that he took on, which was the kind of freedom of an artist to do what he wants to do. You know, all of those left turns and complicated moves and all of the ups and downs of his career, I think to a lot of young artists look kind of heroic almost, you know, a willingness not to, you know, play the commercial game, not to play a record company's game, not to play even fans' expectations games, you know, just doing what you want to do. And that element of Lou Reed and opening up the possibilities of what songs can be in terms of the material that they address, I think that's why he's so important, and that's why he's so influential. And it's, you know, it's artists and, ironically enough, writers who have kept Lou Reed and the Velvet Underground alive. You know, there's no aspect of, you know, the strain of alternative music and rock and roll that is not touched by Lou Reed and the Velvet Underground. And, you know, that's significant. So it's not necessarily, yeah, I mean, it's certainly not something that, you know, you often hear on the radio or that you encounter, you know, it's not in every household. But its significance is deep and long-lasting, and it takes a while. But when you get in there, you realize the significance of it.
Thanks for listening to Martin Van Dyke Undercovers for April 2018. Our interview was with Rolling Stone writer Anthony DeCurtis about his new book, Lou Reed, A Life. This has been a presentation of the Ann Arbor District Library.
Jenny said when she was just 5 years old, there was nothing happening at all.